If you have a bachelor's degree and live anywhere in the United States, there's now a way for you to take your bourbon education to the next level. The Distilled Spirits Business Certificate from the University of Louisville is a six-course online program, and it will prepare you for the business side of the spirits industry. Offered by the AACSB Accredited College of Business, this certificate is taught by business professors and industry leaders from Brown-Forman, Jack Daniels, and more. Get enrolled into this online program at ufl.me/bourbonpursuit. There's a new award-winning four-grain bourbon that's been taking the market by storm. It's Penelope Bourbon. Bottled at the historic Castle & Key Distillery, Penelope's balanced yet flavorful taste profile comes from a unique blend of three bourbon mash bills. It's currently available in two expressions, 80 proof and cash strength. It fits your mood whether you're sipping neat or in a cocktail. Penelope is available in select markets as well as online at PenelopeBourbon.com.
We have a mix of barrels as well. So half of our barrels are a number four char, the other half are a number three char, but with a toast.
Because you guys hate consistency, apparently.
Yep. Yeah. We try to make everything as complicated as possible so that we don't remember how we did anything.
Can't scale anything.
Yeah.
This is episode 267 of Bourbon Pursuit, the podcast featuring news, reviews, and interviews with people making the bourbon whiskey industry happen. And before we start the podcast, here's your weekly bourbon news update. Dick Stoll, master distiller for Stolen Wolf and former distiller for Michter's, passed away this week on August 13th. Dick was responsible for the glory days of rye whiskey coming out of Pennsylvania around 30 plus years ago at the legendary Schaeferstown, Pennsylvania. He was trained by C. Everett Beam in both the Beam family and historical Pennsylvania styles, and Dick served as the master distiller of Pennsylvania Michter's, where he also distilled the famed A.H. Hirsch bourbon. Michter's closed its doors in 1990 and was picked up a few years later by Chatham Imports, where the decision was made to move it down to Kentucky. Our thoughts and prayers go out to the Stoll family. Buffalo Trace is moving forward with its $1.2 billion expansion that spans every part of production. In this past year alone, they've erected three new warehouses and filled them with barrels, joining the already existing four new warehouses that were constructed last year that are now full. And another three are already on the way, each of them holding 58,800 barrels, which costs around $7 million to construct and $21 million to fill. The distillery has also installed four new cookers, which doubles their old volume, four new fermenters to add to the already 12 that have been in use since 1933, a new cooling tower, a new high-speed bottling line, and more to come. And this year, the Kids Cancer Alliance is hosting an online bourbon auction called Concert for the Cause. 100% of the proceeds will benefit the Kids Cancer Alliance's programs for kids with cancer and their families. The Kids Cancer Alliance relies on this event as its largest source of individual donations each year. And big ticket items up for grabs is a bourbon pull, where you can win one of 100 bottles in a package, plus an online auction featuring Weller Foolproof, an Old Forester collection, and bottles of Pursuit series that have been donated by the People's Champ. And lastly, a whole barrel of Blanton's, where you and seven guests can go and pick your own barrel. The auction opens on August 20th, and the live broadcast will be on August 22nd at 7:30 p.m. You can get bidding now at the kidscanceralliance.org/concert. Or you can text CONCERT 2020 to 243-725. Now moving on to bourbon release news. Traverse City Whiskey has been releasing barrel-proof editions of its bourbon and rye whiskey for years, but this week marked the first time they unveiled a barrel-proof take on its cherry whiskey, also known as the American Cherry Edition. The cherry harvest in northern Michigan comes around once a year at the peak of summer, and cherries are taken from the orchard straight to the distillery so they can be added to the whiskey, where they rest for around 3 days. And due to the short steeping process, there is constant attention to the batch and sampling it at almost every level to make sure that you achieve that perfect hint of cherry. And the barrel proof expression this year is offered at 110.2 proof with an SRP of $79.99. It will be available at the distillery. And for today's podcast, what do you think it's like to put everything on the line to see if one of your experimental barrels will produce a whiskey that the whole world will enjoy? Well, that's a question that Tim Pearsant and Grant McCracken get to answer on today's podcast. It's a story of government lobbying and a lot of experimentation, but ultimately finding an identity in whiskey that's producing amazing results. And Chattanooga whiskey is one that you're going to want to know about. By now, you know that Barrel Bourbon is doing great things and that you can get a bottle of one of their crafted blends shipped right to your doorstep. Go to barrelbourbon.com and click the Buy Now button. With that, enjoy today's episode. And here's Fred Minnick with Above the Char.
I'm Fred Minnick, and this is Above the Char. If you've been following bourbon for a while, you might find it comical to see the Van Winkle line and the Buffalo Trace Antique Collection and the Four Roses Limited Edition small batch, you know, be priced, you know, in a certain SRP that does not really capture the true demand. And I've been getting a lot of interest from national reporters lately about the kind of the hoax that is the bourbon SRP. And some of it's the distiller's fault, a lot of it's the distributor's fault, but at the end of the day, it's the retailer who puts the price tag up in a store and makes the decision to market up whatever percentage they market up. Now, what am I willing to pay over SRP? Well, recently, I spent probably 20, 30% more than the SRP suggests for something like Wild Turkey 101. I've spent over SRP for bottles of Willett, bottles of Heaven Hill, like Parker's Heritage. I mean, I've spent stupid money on bourbon, don't get me wrong. But for the basic everyday bourbons, man, I don't want to be spending I don't want to spend more than 20% over SRP. Now, if it's a kind of like a mid-tier limited edition, I might be willing to pay 40% over SRP. But I think that's a question that all of us have to ask ourselves is like, what are we willing to spend over the suggested retail price? Now, I'll tell you what, I'm giving the retailer the big fat finger who's got a bottle behind a glass case and it says $2,000 underneath it, or he's got something, he doesn't have a price tag on there, and he's like, yeah, make me an offer. I mean, that kind of stuff is just hokey, and it doesn't do anybody any good. And all the retailers who are doing that are getting called out constantly on Instagram and other forms of social media. So I think it's a bad move to be way overpricing anything on bourbon. But still, there's that fundamental question of like, what are you willing to pay over SRP? And it reminds me of a story when I was in high school, and we were raising Chester hogs at the time. And I had this opportunity to buy this Chester, and I thought he would just really change the dynamic of our herd. Well, I was on one side of the auction and my father was on the other side. And we were bidding against each other. Didn't know it. He didn't know it. I didn't know it. But come to find out, we were both willing to pay $400 for that pig before we ever even saw like what the demand for it was or the value of it was. In our head, it was a $400 pig. So I think that's what I'm going to start doing from now on. And that's why I've been doing what I've been doing on the YouTube series where I'm tasting things in price points. I'm going to start looking at bottles of bourbon and saying, you know what? You're a $35 bottle of bourbon. Why don't you join my liquor cabinet? And that's this week's Above the Char. Hey, go check out my YouTube series where I am doing all this cool stuff. And today, Thursday, launching the Bourbon Women Symposium, a live stream tonight at 6 o'clock. Go check it out. Until next week, cheers.
Welcome back to the episode of Bourbon Pursuit, the official podcast of bourbon. Kenny and Ryan back in our official recording studios today talking to a whiskey company that kind of caught us by surprise a little bit. We had gotten one of their meaty samples in the mail. And you know, it's one of those things that always happens to us. We get meaty samples in the mail and we're like, here we go again.
Oh God, here we go. You know, you're like, we're grateful and gracious that people send us stuff. But yeah, a lot of times it's not good. And to our surprise, you know, and we're like, looking at it and we're like, it's just not going to be. And then we tried it and we're like, oh my gosh, you know, and it's super exciting because, you know, we grew up in Kentucky and there's so many good distilleries here, but you know, it's with allocated products and all the popular with bourbon, it's harder to get Kentucky stuff. So we're really excited to have like some good guys out of, you know, the state of Kentucky doing some great things in the whiskey business.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of those things that we want to look outside of the state as well, because as we start seeing a lot more distilleries start coming up, a lot more aged product getting out there as well, it's going to start changing the minds of a lot of the consumers out there too. And so we're really excited to be able to introduce one of the distilleries that we have kind of grown to love a lot. You know, we've put out a review on Whiskey Quickie before that we really enjoyed it. We've talked about it. We put it on a bunch of social media. So we want to go ahead. And today we're going to be talking about the Chattanooga Whiskey Company.
Choo choo.
Now, yeah. I was waiting for you to bring that one out.
Every time I think of Chattanooga, just goes straight to choo choo. I don't know.
It's okay.
Sorry, guys.
So let's go ahead and
you're stuck with it.
Yeah. It at least for today, at least.
You can make t-shirts, though. You're right.
We're going to stick to whiskey. Yeah. We'll let trains be trains.
Yeah. You are right across from the train station.
We are. Yeah. No, we look at it
all the time. Yeah. All the time. So let's go ahead and introduce our guest today. So today on the show, we have Tim Pearson. He is the founder of Chattanooga Whiskey Company, as well as Grant McCracken, the head distiller. So, guys, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us. Thank you. Yeah. Having us, appreciate
thank you for driving up. A lot of times we got to drive too, and so we appreciate you coming here.
We got some good bonding times.
Yeah,
that's all totally
nice. See, yeah, that's what it's all about. You finally get a chance to really connect on more than a whiskey level. Yeah, right. Like, hey, what's more than what are you doing this weekend, right? You gotta talk about your past, your history.
It's mainly art. It was just arguing about music on the way. That's what it was 90% of the time.
Which way do you lean on? What's your genre choice?
I mean, we're the same age.
We overlap a lot. We grew up in the 90s, so we're in our late 30s and we're, you know, children of the grunge movement. So,
yeah,
you know, along with that comes, you know, Pearl Jam, Nirvana, and then, classic rock, a lot of classic rock.
It's all kind of like within that, really, who we think had the most impact. It's kind of that we were arguing about the top 50 list and who's in the top 50.
Yeah.
So
who's your top five then? Can you have, or let's say top one or two?
This is where the argument comes in, because I think, so I grew up, I have an older brother and we were both musicians, and playing, you know, rock music in the prime of the grunge era, and being a drummer, more of a drummer than a guitarist, but I really gravitated towards kind of the top five are pretty easy for me. You know, of course I was a huge Pearl Jam fan, huge Nirvana fan, Soundgarden, Smashing Pumpkins, Stone Temple Pilots, Alice in Chains. I mean, I you could go on and on and on.
I was sitting there the other day, and Tonight came on. I was like, man, I haven't heard this forever. Yeah. It brought back so many memories.
Yeah.
Of like seventh grade dances.
And then we get into like the argument where, you know, like where does REM fit into the mix?
They
you know?
Don't.
I mean.
No, I'm kidding.
They don't. Case closed.
Right.
Thank you, Ryan. I appreciate that.
Yep.
It's the end of the world as we know it.
Yeah. Yeah. So I grew up on Nirvana and Pearl Jam. I feel like the Pixies made a huge impact on me when I was growing up, and Built to Spill was kind of where
I Built to Spill
transition from Nirvana into more of, you know, the late 90s kind of stuff, and
more
that's
indie
how I grew
scene,
up
yeah.
Least, yeah, totally.
Very cool.
So we're already kind of talking about your passion and history. Let's dive into it a little bit more. So kind of talk about really, you know, how y'all grew up and stuff like that. I mean, you had a musician's background, right, Tim? So kind of talk about like what made you do that, and kind of what like carved your path to the career where you said, hey, maybe whiskey's for me.
So I'm not sure that being a musician, I can really connect the dots very easily. I think where I can connect the dots is, I guess there was an originality there. Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed writing music, you know? I mean, I would, I had this little, I don't tell the story ever. You've never even heard this, but when I was growing up,
more stories to go back on the ride home with.
Yeah, exactly. We had, so my dad was a musician, and so my brother and I got, you know, musical instruments fairly early in life, you know, pre-10. And so I would keep a guitar near my bed, and I would keep a boombox with a tape recorder and a microphone connected, because I would wake up in the middle of the night with ideas. And I would, as soon as an idea hit me, you know, my parents, you know, slept down the hallway, so I'd sleep with my door shut, because I did this often. An idea would hit me in the middle of the night, and I would get out of bed and literally just flip the lights on, go, you know, hit record and play whatever this riff was, or, you know, whatever the tune was stuck in my head so that I didn't forget it, because otherwise I definitely would. So I wrote songs a lot that way. And I wasn't, you know, I wasn't a talented music reader, you know. Everything was by ear, and it was very much just kind of figuring it out, you know, along the way by ear. And I think that's kind of how this happened. And I had parents that were very supportive of that. My dad was an entrepreneur. I was actually working in a, you know, family business for 8 years. And so...
What was the family business?
It was manufacturing, and mainly point of purchase display manufacturing. And it just wasn't for me long term. But growing up, my dad went from being an entrepreneur to leaving the private sector and going into 501c3 work. And, you know, nonprofit work.
Yeah, and say where all the money's at, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. And that, and so he sacrificed for something that he was passionate about, and then ended up going back into you know, manufacturing, and it just wasn't for me long term. But he was in ministry for, I mean, all the nonprofit work was ministry work, and that was the majority of my life. So 8 years or 7 years after working for him, coming to him and saying, you know, hey, so we're going to start a whiskey company was a interesting conversation. But
how did you get the whiskey from, like, were you drinking it or did you enjoy it? Like,
I think he probably woke up in the middle of the night.
Yeah,
did you
hit record on his boombox and just like, started talking?
I'm going to start a whiskey company.
You know, here's the thing. Like, I'm not shy about the fact that, like, it wasn't in my bloodline, right? It's not my great grandfather didn't wasn't a distiller, you know. So it was about the history of whiskey in Chattanooga, discovering it at a time where in 2011 it was still illegal. And a buddy of mine and I, you know, were looking at this, and both of us, so I mean, technically I'm a co-founder, but we're not even getting into that story today. So but we were looking at this together and said, holy cow, how have people not brought that back? How has it not been brought back? I mean, Jack Daniels is 80 miles up the road, right? And it's 2011. And we were really excited about it. And Facebook was a platform that was just open and people could see what you posted. And it was very unfiltered. And we started with the idea on Facebook with a question, would you drink Chattanooga whiskey? And that's how it rolled from there. So very much a passion thing. Very, I guess, entrepreneurship is in my veins because of my dad. But good timing and something that to make a difference, to make an impact, to bring something back after 100 years in Chattanooga was just a really cool opportunity.
So it was distilling in Chattanooga was illegal back in 2011.
It was, yeah, it was illegal. So there's 95 counties in the state of Tennessee, and it was illegal in the majority of the 95 counties. And Chattanooga, and some major markets in there, Chattanooga being one of them, that dated back to 1915. So from 1866 to 1915, Chattanooga was one of the larger distilling communities in North America, which is an interesting, you know, fact that a lot of people don't know about. Certainly Chattanoogans didn't know about it. And the legislation, you know, didn't know about it, nor did they really care to bring something back that wouldn't necessarily, in their minds, benefit them or the community, right? The health of the community. So discovering that was what inspired us. But, you know, you had to be passionate enough and kind of crazy enough to change, to take that on, to change the laws. And that's where the Vote Whiskey campaign came in and all that.
Okay, we'll get to that. I'm going to get to that in a minute because I feel like we need to bring Grant back to this over here. So,
it's
so,
all good.
Yeah,
these are good stories.
So Grant, it's your turn to lay on the couch now and kind of tell us about your childhood and how you grew up and got into whiskey too.
Yeah, so actually, I like Tim, diverged paths in life. I went to business school at Indiana University. And
I really didn't have a plan coming out of business school. So what do you do when you don't have a plan coming out of business school? You go into consulting, which is what I did. So I was a consultant for five years. And
consulting what though?
Business consulting. So I worked for Accenture and Protiviti, which were both knockoffs of Anderson Consulting. So I did a lot of supply chain consulting. I did some inventory management consulting. I did risk auditing, all pretty boring stuff, right?
Sounds exciting.
Yeah, a lot of spreadsheets, a lot of PowerPoint presentations, a lot of, presenting to boards information that, you know, they already knew. They just didn't have the people to do it themselves.
They needed it in a pie chart.
Yeah, really exactly. Yeah. So I was homebrewing on the side in college and through my consulting career. And at a certain point, I realized I feel like I'm probably better at this homebrewing thing than consulting, which wasn't saying much, I will tell you that. What was it, 2008, I went back to school for brewing. I left the consulting world, business world, went to school for brewing, got through that, landed my first job in a large craft brewer in Boston Beer Company is where I worked. I'll just say the name. They make Sam Adams.
Yep.
So I worked for them for almost 6 years. I worked in production. I worked in recipe development and head brewer at research and development in their Boston location. And on the side, then I was learning how to distill in my own time. We did a lot of high gravity brewing, a lot of barrel aging stuff. And it just became like a little side hobby for me again. So just like brewing was a side hobby when I was in the business consulting world, distilling just became a hobby from an educational perspective. So I did a distance course in distilling, and serendipitously, like 3 weeks after, I was looking back at the emails actually, 3 weeks after I finished this distilling course, got my certificate in distilling, I get a call from a good friend of mine who's in the distilling industry. And he called me and said, these guys from Chattanooga, they're here at the distillery and they're looking for a distiller. Didn't know if you'd be interested in talking to him. And I said, well, yeah, let's see what happens. And then made a trip to Chattanooga, and here we are. So that's 15 years compressed into 2 minutes. But that's essentially how that.
What was it about distilling that made you like venture off from brewing?
Oh, man. I mean, what I started to realize in distilling was that, you know, a lot of the assumptions we were talking about earlier today, I feel like it's in groups of a third. So a third of distilling is just like brewing. A lot of same essentials. The concepts are very similar. Fermentation, managing or selection of different raw materials, very similar.
Yeast, all that stuff.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, there's a third that's the same. There's a third where actually your assumptions and all the rules are turned absolutely upside down. Oxygen's one of them. Bacteria is another thing that, just too thrown out there. And then the other third is just a completely different new way of thinking. And that's that extra step of distilling, you know, throwing it through a column, purifying it, concentrating certain aromas and characteristics. And the barrel aging piece is somewhat similar, but there's some factors in there that are just new points of discovery. So third, a third, a third. Third is same stuff. Third is challenging your assumptions. And third is a lot of new things. And I think that combination of, okay, this isn't too far beyond my comprehension. I can learn something new that totally changes the way that I think about beer and whiskey all together. And it was just really interesting to me. So it turned into, it was a hobby at first and turned into, you know, I like the long-term focus of this. It's something that I feel like I could do for a very long time.
So to say, when you were undergrad and doing this in school, like, were you like the most popular one? Like, hey, this guy's he's making his own beer over here. Let's go over there.
Well, I would, it took me a while to actually really get into it. And that was right outside of college. I felt like I was the guy, you know, really interested in the process, but not in getting into the guts of it in college. And then post-college, I had a really good friend
who worked with me in consulting, and we both got into homebrewing together, and it was like every book we could get, we were just gobbling it up. Oh, yeah. I mean, that's where the true, a lot of the joy comes in it for me, is all those little details, figuring out, you know, what, how to bring it together and the seek of perfection in a way.
So you got a favorite kind of beer?
You know, people ask me that a lot. I feel like it's the same with whiskey, is when a style is done well and it's the nail is hit on the head, anyone will do. If, you know, if you have a classic American Pilsner or a German Pilsner, all the way to, you know, a Rauch beer, or a barley wine, I will drink anything you put in front of me as long as it is, you know, an excellent example. I feel like you can take a lot from any particular style.
Even IPAs.
Yeah, no, I'm cool with them. Yeah.
We were talking earlier before how we were like, oh, IPAs.
What do you think about the whole craze of like the hazy IPAs and stuff that's going on right now? And people are like putting all kinds of like fruit and stuff in them. And like,
I mean,
come on, be real. Like, what do you think?
You know, I think every industry works in trends, and there's a certain element of the industries, even in distilling and making whiskey, you do have to kind of go along with what the market is interested in, or else you won't survive, right? But there is a certain amount of kind of
gimmick.
And ADD of just, you know, focus on the fundamentals kind of thing. If you can get the fundamentals right and bring an evolution of a particular style that's elegant and interesting and truly has a nice story and profile, I'm all for it. But yeah, at a certain point, there's things on the fringe that will probably be gone in a matter of months, you know?
That's how it works. All right, Beer Pursuit coming to a new podcast interview. <That's> right. So Tim, I kind of want to take it back into a direction that you had mentioned a little bit earlier, you know, talking about how it was illegal to distill at some point, and you talked about some like a voter pass that had to happen. Kind of talk about what that did and what was the catalyst that sort of made that movement happen. Like, were you a big proponent behind it, or like, were you just like, hey, like this thing got passed, let's go ahead and start moving?
No, I do believe that myself and co-founder were the catalyst. We wanted to bring distilling back to Chattanooga for the first time in 100 years.
So did you grow up in Chattanooga? Like,
I did. Born and raised.
Awesome. You know?
The only time I really spent away from Chattanooga for the most part was, you know, when I as it was college. So, when Chattanooga Whiskey was founded in 2011, it was about telling the kind of the story of the history of distilleries in Chattanooga. And it was about how we, you know, eventually wanted to bring distilling back to Chattanooga. But the laws people didn't know about the laws for the most part. And that really goes across most of the state of Tennessee. With the exception of 2009, there was a bill that went through, and that opened up a handful of counties in Tennessee. And that was kind of the beginning of the craft, distilling movement in Tennessee in 2009. Nashville was one of the areas that was approved to distill back then. But for the majority of the state of Tennessee, you know, it still was prohibited. So in Chattanooga being, you know, kind of when we came along a couple of years later, at the center of that, the attention, center of attention of the whole craft distilling movement, because we wanted to make it legal in Chattanooga. But the only way that we could do that is if we made it legal really in the rest of the state of Tennessee. We thought it was only going to be a county, like, hey, why don't you just, the 2009 bill, why don't you just adopt Hamilton County, which is Chattanooga, into the 2009 bill? And it just wasn't going to be that easy, even though we still had to go through a county vote. So we created a campaign called the Vote Whiskey Campaign. I say we, that was me and my co-founder that created that. And the reason that we created Vote Whiskey is because people just didn't know enough. They weren't going to do the research on their own. It was very difficult to get the messaging out there. So we just needed something creative and loud to galvanize community support. So we started that shortly after we were founded. And the laws didn't change until 2013. It was spring of 2013.
So you founded a company. basically trying to create something that was already, it was going to be illegal, and just like hope down the line that this was going to come to fruition?
Basically, we did. But it was exciting, and we were, you know, young and passionate enough to take it on, and we believed in the mission, and we had a lot of community support. But what was kind of interesting about it is in 2011, shortly after we found we were packaging together our raw materials, because we wanted to sell Chattanooga whiskey. But the only way we could sell Chattanooga whiskey is if we sourced a product. And so there were not a lot of third party manufacturers out there, or contract manufacturers out there, that supplied whiskey in 2011. And we you know, found a handful, and one of them was LDI, which became MGP. And we had samples shipped to us, and our favorite samples, and we didn't know anything about LDI. We knew nothing about
it. It's good whiskey.
That's legitimately, we got the samples and we were like, holy cow, this is really, really good whiskey. The samples we got were 3 years old. And we said, this is the whiskey we want to start with. So what do we need? And they said, our minimum is 20 barrels. You have to buy 20 barrels from us if you want to purchase any whiskey at all. So, we basically scrounged up $50,000 of mezzanine debt from friends of family members and just locals, basically a couple locals, one in particular that I'll never forget. It was a huge part of why we're here. But we came up with that money to buy 20 barrels. And then we packaged the labels and the glass and, you know, everything together. And it was about telling the story of the history of Chattanooga whiskey, or whiskey in Chattanooga, right? We wanted to honor tradition in Tennessee, or specifically in Chattanooga. So we had this look and vibe that we were going after. We launched in April of 2012, and the launch was great, but we had to be really transparent that it wasn't made in Chattanooga.
Right.
We had to tell people because of our mission. Our mission was to bring it back, so we really didn't have anything to hide because of that. And we got, you know, the community, we had more that supported, but of course, telling people that this is called Chattanooga whiskey made in Indiana was not easy. So we had to kind of fight that battle while we were, you know, fighting the underground battle that hadn't come to the surface yet, and that was that it was illegal.
Yeah, I was about to say, because at that point, it was a good thing that you went honesty first, because we already saw the repercussions of people that didn't do that years down the road, right? Yeah. Talking 2014, 2015 timeframe.
Yeah, it was really important for us to be transparent. And again, because of our mission, and we didn't have any examples to go off of people that weren't necessarily trying to hide the truth, because it was still pretty early in the bourbon boom, you know, and the craft distilling movement. So we didn't have a lot of examples to look at and say, oh man, they really screwed up. Like, we need to make sure that we're really, it was just that our mission was to honor the community and bring distilling back for the first time in 100 years. Interestingly, we ended up, so when LDI was acquired by MGP, they came to us and said, hey, you know, we've found suitors for all of our liquid assets, and you know, we had basically, it was going to shut our supply off because we were only buying 20 barrels at a time. So we had to come up with the money to buy enough barrels to last us as many years to change the laws, raise the capital, build a distillery, come out with our own product.
This sounds just like a
try doing that calculation.
Yeah. I was about to say, I was like, even you gotta respect the hustle here, because this is something that any way that you would try to put this down on paper, it just sounds like
doesn't make sense. It's
a recipe for disaster.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it sounds like you're just trying to, like, you're building the airplane as it flies, right? You're trying to figure out exactly like how this is gonna work. And so, you know, you were able to scrounge up money, but was there other ways that you were bootstrapping this other than just like friends and family? Like, what other ways? Yeah.
No, it truly was. My dad always had a, you know, solid job because he's a good, hardworking man. And so our family was always taken care of, but it was never a dollar of family money or anything like that. It was us trying to figure it out and get, you know, get the, get the money as honestly as we could, wherever we could find it. And it was passion driven constantly. And so we came up with this, you know, we built this pro forma that said that we're going to do all this in 4 years, and that in 4 years it was going to, you know, we would need precisely 1200 barrels to do all this in 4 years. And so that's what we did. We bought 1200 barrels from, I basically went to LDI and I said, hey, can you give me some time? Because the product, their whiskey was being sold, or they had it under contract, but they had, you know, but we were the little guy, right? And I was like, hey, you know, protect the little guy here and see if you can give us a little bit of time. So they give us a couple of weeks, and we came up with the money, which I think at the time was $750,000, to buy 1200 barrels. And so I don't know, I can't remember the exact calculation, but it was like $550 a barrel. So try finding, you know, original LDI barrels at north of 3 years old.
Now, could you store these in Chattanooga legally?
So we had to, so we were originally going to Bardstown. We were going from LDI to
Strong Spirit or something.
Yep, that's right.
Yeah.
And then we switched when laws changed and a bottler opened up in near Nashville, we moved from Strong Spirits down to Nashville, a co-packer basically in Nashville. And then of course we were with them until the Vote Whiskey campaign was successful. And even when the Vote Whiskey campaign was successful, we were still at the beginning of the roller coaster ride. And it was, you know, we thought the laws were going to take a few months to change. It took a couple of years to change. We thought that, you know, after a few months, we'd build the first distillery. So it was a couple of years of changing laws and then 2 more years to build our first distillery. We were actually fortunate that we were still the first distillery in Chattanooga in 100 years. And it was kind of funny how it worked out, because we established the Chattanooga Whiskey Experimental Distillery in March of 2015. And the last distillery shut down in Chattanooga in 1915. So we say making up for 100 years of prohibition because of that.
Well, and it's perfect timing too, because like Chattanooga is kind of doing a renaissance as a city. Like it was a huge industrial like juggernaut back when, but then it kind of got abandoned.
Yeah.
And now, I didn't know this till I went there, you have like the world's fastest internet or something crazy. And like, you're like, what, in Chattanooga, Tennessee? And cause I was going there and there was like all these young people. It was vibrant, tons of great restaurants.
Yeah.
Everybody was just super friendly. I was like, what is going on? They're like, well, we have the world's fastest internet. There's a lot of young companies, tech companies moving here because of the tax advantages of Tennessee. And so it's kind of like perfect timing for you guys too.
That momentum helped us a lot. Yeah, who would have guessed that we went from the first train to cross the Mason-Dixon line to the fastest internet in the world or country? But there was a lot of momentum, there was a lot of startup momentum, and that definitely helped us. I mean, there were a couple of venture funds that had started up in Chattanooga, and so there's so many great people in Chattanooga, and it's a very charitable city as well, and very passionate community, you know? And so bringing this like historical manufacturing element back, you know, reviving it in Chattanooga was something that was of interest to a lot of investors. And so we were fortunate in that regard, but we had to change laws to get there. So like during the campaigning, we were kind of lining up investors, you know, one at a time, but they weren't going to put any money in until the laws actually changed. So then the laws changed, and then we had from 2013, 2014, had a bit of, co-founder turmoil. And then in 2015 is when, we established, finally got our feet on the ground, if you will, in terms of just being a distiller. And so, I'm not going to lie, from 2011, because it took from 2011 to 2015, and this whole time we were advertising Chattanooga whiskey made in Indiana after the laws changed. And then it didn't, because the fact that it didn't happen right away, there were a lot of questions like, are these guys for real? Are they actually going to make something? Did we just support something, you know, for this, you know, for the sake of
really passing a bill to pass a bill.
nothing actually happened, just for the sake of marketability, if you will. And we were trying to build something much larger than what we actually built in 2015. We wanted to be one of the largest craft distilleries in the country because we felt like that was the opportunity that we had. And when we built a, you know, less than 3,000 square foot experimental distillery on Market Street, that was a pretty big change in plans for us. And it became about just planting our feet and figuring out who we were going to be when we grew up. And it was during, it was before, it was like right before we started construction, we found this, you know, this small location on Market Street. And that was when I was like, I'm not going to be the distiller. And we didn't have anybody. We didn't have anybody on the, to be the distiller. So
this goes back to the very beginning. We're like, oh, we got this far. We don't know how to distill. Yeah, right.
We don't, it's illegal. We don't know how to distill.
That's the truth. Yeah. We
I love it. This is like, this reminds me of like a story like Elijah Craig burnt barrels or something. Like you couldn't make this shit up. Like, you know.
No, it's
like,
true.
You're going to look back 100 years from now and they're like, remember Tim, he started a company that was illegal to distill.
And then he didn't know how to distill himself. Yeah. So yeah.
They're like, that's just folklore bullshit. You know?
Well, and then we, you know, that's where we found, that's when we found, we were fortunate to find Grant. And what was cool about finding Grant is that our philosophies aligned, because Cheddar New was we were already kind of established as you know, we were trailblazing, right? I mean, to change laws. And so why do all this just to Grant and I were talking about this earlier, and Grant, you know, said basically pull out tracing paper and trace over 1816. You know, that was MGP. And why do all that to just pull out tracing paper? Mm-hmm. And so, but we loved it. But we loved that. We loved the path, and we liked the product. You know, so we didn't want to just sweep it under the rug and pretend like it never existed. And so when Grant came on board and helped us build the experimental distillery, and of course
Grant, yeah, I want to hear Grant's side. Like, yeah, how did you sell this dream to him, to Grant?
That, yeah, actually, actually, yeah, go ahead. Yeah, so the. So my good friend gave me a call, asked me if I'd be interested in talking with these guys. And actually, one of the first things I went online just to look around, what is this thing? Well, Chattanooga, I used to stop there when I was a kid on the way to Florida. I don't remember it being that cool of a town. And I start to see pictures and the landscape. I remember the landscape just being gorgeous. Mm-hmm. You know, it's you know, there. Foot of the Appalachian, you know, contour. It's just an amazing area of the country. And I come across this, one of their like old websites or ads that just said, rules are good, change them. And that was their Vote Whiskey campaign kind of sub motto. And, you know, we were talking about rock and roll music earlier. I was like, if that isn't the most rock and roll thing in the world, I don't know what is. And so, and that was my first kind of visual and, you know, statement of what they were about. And I thought, well, if that's what they're about, I think that's really cool. I need to go talk to these guys. So I made a trip to Chattanooga and saw the same thing you guys saw, you know, the whole town has undergone quite a bit of change, but it's a change that kind of, takes the best of what the town is all about. It's about the outdoors. You know, we were Outside Magazine's best town in the country, best town ever, like 2 or 3 years, something like that. So there's a lot to be cherished in that area of the country. And yeah, there's this kind of youthful renaissance in the town. And from the standpoint of, you know, selling the idea of the distillery, I just got the feeling that Tim was open to changing the rules again, you know, to start the company, founding it off of principles that said, rules are good, honor your tradition, but we can evolve. We can move past these things and try to keep moving on and building on the things we love. So, there was kind of a natural amount of respect and kind of rock and roll at swagger on those two things that I just thought was really cool.
So when you guys got together, Tim, were you like, this is what I'm looking for? This is the style of whiskey I want to make. This is this. Or was it more like, let's lean on him and let him figure that out for us?
So when Grant, so we did a phone interview, and what I really enjoyed about that interview is that Grant was just extremely thoughtful And he, I felt like he chose his words wisely, and he really wasn't, you know, it was, it's just who he was as a person. And when Grant, you know, Grant's very much a perfectionist, and I could feel that in that conversation, and we needed that. I mean, A, like, first of all, we couldn't distill or brew ourselves, right? So let's just start with the foundation, but we needed, but our company needed, when we planted our feet, we needed somebody extremely trustworthy and somebody who could, you know, really commit to making, you know, a great product. And so I got that from Grant. And then when Grant and his wife came down with their, at the time, they just had one child, their son. And, my wife and I had a daughter. We've got now both have two kids, and we spent a weekend together. It just, it felt right. It felt like Grant was just what Chattanooga Whiskey needs. We were, I mean, from 2011 to 2014, it was like the wild, wild west. I mean, we were just all over the place, you know, just trying,
trying to make it work.
Trying to make it work. And that's what the Vote Whiskey campaign was all about. And it was just a dream, right? And we were just trying to tell this story and get people to believe it and buy into it to change laws. And now it was kind of, you know, it was time to grow up. And that's not an easy thing to say, because I don't ever want to grow up. I mean, I don't, but it was time to grow up. And then we had shareholders, you know, we had shareholders that invested in 2013, and those shareholders were with us, you know, through some tough times in 2013, 2014. And so they were kind of looking at me, looking at Chattanooga Whiskey going, you know, I wonder if this thing is going to work. And so we had to re-gear. So, you know,
the experimental distillery.
Yeah. We reset. We decided we were gonna do something smaller. It was the experimental distillery. Grant was going to be our head distiller.
Is that your idea to do the smaller distillery, or was that their?
No, actually it kind of came together at the same moment. I think I started talking to them as they were envisioning this larger facility. Yep. And I'm kind of looking at this gigantic building that was on the list of buildings that they had looked at, and like, am I in over my head? And I haven't professionally distilled once in my whole life, you know? And so when they told me they were thinking of starting an experimental distillery, I was like, ah, okay. Kind of a relief. You know, at a certain point, you want the biggest and best for whatever company you work for, right? But one foot in front of the other kind of mentality, this was absolutely the best thing that could have happened to the company, because I feel like we had 2 years from 2015 to 2017 to figure out exactly what we wanted to make. And that's what the experimental distillery's whole concept was all about, is let's figure this out. Who do we want to be? Again, you know, Tim mentioned the tracing paper. We didn't want to just take a traditional bourbon, you know, put a sheet over it and trace over it and say, oh, we're going to just change this little bit, and or some sort of remix of 1816. We wanted to look at every piece of the process under a microscope to decide, you know, what we liked, how it was going to pull as much flavor as possible from that part of the process, and what raw materials and what process would yield the best whiskey possible.
So. Yeah, and I absolutely followed Grant's lead on that. What was cool is that when Grant came in, is that he did adopt the rules are good, change them philosophy instantly. And so that's how so we were under construction, the experimental distillery together. And when we finished construction, it was time to distill our first batch. We kind of looked at each other like, all right, like,
pushing the button?
Yeah. What are we going to make? And we decided our first batch should be an 1816 knockoff. So that was our very first batch at experimental. And then from there, it was about, okay, what is rules are good, change them? What does that mean? And Grant's background, he can talk to this obviously a lot more than I can, but it was an introductory of malt into bourbon. All right. So it was like, all right, let's not alienate. One of our trademark slogans is whiskey to the people. Let's honor this path, and let's honor that the community support that we've galvanized under this product. That's a traditional straight bourbon whiskey. And it's a great bourbon, by the way. And it's what we love. But like, how can this translate into rules are good, change them? And that's where Grant had ideas about how he wanted to develop that, that I didn't. And that's where I really leaned on him and his expertise. And we were talking about this earlier on the way up, but we're not going to sit here and tell you guys or anybody that the first 2 years of experimental distilling was like just a buildup to the perfect recipe. It wasn't. I mean, we started off with nothing, you know, but 1816 in barrels. So we didn't have any high malt. We didn't have any Tennessee high malt in barrels. So we were going off of white whiskey and flavor profiles of white whiskey to figure this out. What do we like? What do we not like? We're deciding this over white whiskey before it goes into a barrel. We tried stuff all the way up to 100% malted. All of our corn was malted. 100% of our corn was malted. So when it comes to what we've truly tried, introducing malt to bourbon, we feel like, and that we say that we have the like truly the only standalone experimental whiskey distillery in the country because of what we went through introducing malts to bourbon and even malting corn and the, you know, hundreds of malts, dozens of yeasts. So we went through this and we had stuff that came off that we didn't like, frankly. I mean, and that was even some of the 100% malt stuff. And so we wanted to do 100%. We're like, man, all of our corn is going to be malted. It's going to be amazing. But it didn't work.
Until you tasted it.
Right. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Yeah. But you're like, that sucked.
But it didn't work. So anyways, that was part of the path to what is Tennessee High Malt today.
Yeah. I mean, two years to figure it out. There were, you know, as you can imagine, you said it earlier, you're building the plane as you're flying it. We're trying to figure out what, you know, what gives us a little bit of lift. And we're kind of veering off in the wrong direction. Let's change paths and push over another direction.
Were y'all just doing it yourself? You didn't have any consultants, like, or anyone kind of guiding you along, or?
So we initially had, I've never met Larry Ebersold, but Larry goes back in the industry. He's something of a legend. And I was fortunate enough to know someone in the industry. Brian Sprance at New Riff worked with Larry. Brian is one of my very close friends. And the folks at Vendome who built our still, and the folks at Vitoc who helped operationally with engineering considerations for our larger distillery. You got to understand, this industry is just very, for lack of a better word, altruistic. And, you know, although you're paying them money to build you stuff, they're very open, open source on what they have seen and what they know works. So operationally speaking, I've personally gotten a lot from those folks, and some others, but, creatively, recipe development wise, we really tried to keep the blinders on from a standpoint of building what we thought was going to make the best whiskey. And that's where it came to just looking at every single part of the process, you know, and it ended up coincidentally ironically, that the foundation of the process, we thought where it all started with malt and foundation of grain became kind of our foundation as a concept. So we call our version of straight whiskey Tennessee High Malt because we feel like it exhibits something a little bit, you know, on the edge of the style. So we kind of consider it our malt forward approach to bourbon, and that's where we started on barrel number two. From barrel number two on, we always tried to kind of put our high malt glasses on and say, here's what we want to, you know, bring to this tradition.
What was it about malt that made you land on that? Was it just because it's different, it's unique?
What do you get if you mix Seattle craft, Texas heritage, and Scottish know-how? That's Two Bar Spirits. Two Bar Spirits traces its roots to a ranch in rural Texas run by the founder, Nathan Kaiser's family, for six generations. Nathan grew up on the ranch with stories of relatives bootlegging moonshine. And after moving into Seattle, he wanted to keep the family tradition alive, and he opened Two Bar Spirits in 2012. They're a very traditional distillery, making everything from scratch, and each day starts by milling 1,000 pounds of grain. Their entire product lineup consists of only two whiskeys, their moonshine and the only bourbon made in Seattle. Both bottles are being featured and Rackhouse Whiskey Club's next box. Rackhouse Whiskey Club is a Whiskey of the Month club, and they're on a mission to uncover the best flavors and stories that craft distilleries across the U.S. have to offer. Rackhouse ships out two of the featured distillery's finest bottles, along with some cool merchandise in a box, delivered to your door every 2 months. Go to RackhouseWhiskeyClub.com to check it out and try some Two Bar for yourself. Use code PURSUIT for $25 off your first box. To enjoy whiskey, all one has to do is drink it. But to understand and experience whiskey, one must participate in its creation. And for over 20 years, the Thousand Oaks Barrel Company has been supplying kits to do just that, including personalized oak barrels ranging from 1 to 20 liters in size to custom-age your own spirits or cocktails. But they now have their newest kit called the Whiskey Experience. And this complete kit allows you to make, age, and taste your own whiskey. The whole package comes with a new American white oak barrel that's 1 or 2 liters in size and includes everything that you need to make 10 different styles of whiskey from around the world, including American whiskey, Irish, Scottish, Japanese, and Canadian. So, are you ready to take the journey? Visit 1000oaksbarrel.com, which is number 1000oaksbarrel.com, and use code BP2020 to get 10% off your very own Whiskey Experience kit.
What was it about malt that made you land on that? Was it just because it's different, it's unique, you know, because there's not a lot of bourbons, you know, that kind of celebrate the malt?
There's something to do like malted barley, but I mean, like, other than that, yeah, there's not a whole lot that put a huge chunk of it into it.
Well, I think the biggest point is control, creative control and recipe and flavor control. So if you look at, you know, I get a call a week or at least a call every couple of weeks from a grain supplier, and they say, I can provide you rye or corn or malt. And my biggest question is, okay, what's up with the malt? And there's so many maltsters out there. There's hundreds of maltsters who all approach their craft.
Maltsters. I didn't know they were called that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, there's a craft maltsters guild, and they're all approaching their craft just like a lot of great brewers and distillers are, where you can, you know, malt is essentially you're sprouting a grain and then you're kilning it to stop that process. And you have a choice. You can kind of build a foundational flavor in that malt, or you can roast it, you can caramelize it, you can smoke it, you can roast it to a level that exhibits chocolate type flavors, you can caramelize it to a spectrum of hundreds of different levels that are almost like a paint palette, you know? So when it came to having a selection of raw materials, malt gave us the greatest number of choices to choose from. And I could go to a maltster from Canada, or I could go to a maltster just around the corner at Riverbend, who we use for a lot of specialty products over in North Carolina, who they're trying to figure out new ways of approaching malt as well. So, I mean, when it comes down to it, we thought we had the most amount of control for flavor. And it's not saying that corn isn't a foundational element for our whiskey. As Tim said, you know, if we malted all of that corn, for us, not to get too specific, but it turned in a little too earthy. The corn became the focus, and these nuanced flavors of whether it was caramel or honey or, you know, a fruit character in there that you're trying to heighten or just tweak a little bit, it all kind of got thrown out of balance by malting corn. But corn as a raw material, as a unmalted material, is an amazing canvas to showcase malted grains in all of their spectrum. So when we you know, started laying barrels down at the experimental facility, over those first 2 years, we laid down 100 different barrels, and or approximately 100 different barrels. And when it came time to deciding, okay, we're building this larger production facility in 2017, not to jump ahead too much, but in 2017, we're working on our larger facility that was going to make not a barrel a week like we did at experimental, but now 25 up to probably 60 barrels a week we can make there. So we have to decide which recipe are we going to settle on. So we went through everything. We went through every single recipe, and there's hundreds of malts that we've tried from in this 2-year period. There's dozens of yeasts.
There's dozens of different types of barrels. We've tried a bunch of finishing barrels as well. Anything and everything is on the table for what makes the best whiskey.
And within the framework of straight bourbon whiskey.
Exactly. So although we did do a lot of malt whiskey, we did some rye malt whiskey as well, but we took this kind of broad approach to what we were calling at the time. We were like, well, what do we call it? Tennessee high malt. Okay. What are we making that exhibits Tennessee high malt the most? And we tasted through all of them, and barrel 91 was the one. You know, it was the one that had the right level. It kind of tipped its cap to tradition in just the right way, and it looked towards the future for us in just the right way. So that's why we picked that particular
recipe. So it took you 91 barrels to get there. But I mean, like, how aged was at that point that you're like, okay, like we tell that this has got
heading
some
in the right direction,
future, yeah, potential in it and stuff like that too.
Yeah, I mean, that recipe at the time I think was only probably around a year old.
Yeah,
so we had to put some, you know, our confidence in kind of our crystal ball, you know, you pull it out.
And going, like, back to that pro forma.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, there's every step of the way, you know, we look back now and we're like, Jesus, what a risk at every single step. But I think you just had to believe in your ability to kind of think on your feet, build the plane while it's flying, and figure it out as you go. And I think that's what we share in common from day one, is we can figure it out. If we spend enough time thinking about it, we're going to get it right.
We had a conversation about when we built the experiment, like when we started running our first batches off of the experimental distillery, if we should just focus on a recipe or a couple of recipes versus doing something new every single week. And that was not an easy conversation because it's an investment. Mm-hmm. At that point, and this was one of the riskier things that we did, we had to say, so there was this, okay, the conservative way to go about this is we're going to produce a few recipes, and this is going to be, we're just going to get settled at the experimental distillery, and we're going to try and, you know, make a profit someday off of it. And, you know, and then eventually at some point, we don't know when, we'll go from there.
I want to know these shareholders are dealing with.
They got to be like,
yeah, I mean, very they're like, people. Thank
like,
you.
This yes. sounds like
it's like a terrible.
Sounds like hog shit. Give me my money back.
Yeah, that's a really good question. That's a really good question. I'm happy to share.
No, they must have had a lot of faith in you, because I mean, I really had the same exact questions as you're going through here, and you're like, you had 100 different barrels that, like, you were creating. I'm like,
I would be like, whoa, guys, let's get it together first. Let's like,
I mean, like, let's create.
We had 3 years of trying to get this law passed. Now we're like. Or whatever.
Well, you know what's interesting is none of them come from the industry. None of them, you know. And there was a level of trust. There was a massive level of trust there, and it was that, you know, we kind of reconfigured our pro forma based on, okay, now we have an experimental distillery, and are we going to generate the revenue we say we're going to? Are we going to, you know, make a good product? All that stuff. And we didn't have anybody looking over our shoulders saying, like, you're going to make 1816 or you're going to make a few recipes. I personally had some industry advisors that have, you know, that have been there and done that, built brands, sold them, that said, you should lay down as much whiskey as you possibly can that is the recipe that you are currently selling. And we did the opposite of that, which was.
You're like, no thanks. That's not us.
I know you're really smart.
Yeah,
but we're not gonna.
So when we decided, so Grant, well, actually, it was, I remember like it was yesterday. Grant said, Tim, is this our future? Is the experimental? And we didn't even call it the experimental whiskey distillery back then. We called it the Tennessee Stillhouse. Is the Tennessee Stillhouse our future? Is this 3,000 square foot location, what we're doing here, is this it? And that's fine if it is. It's not a bad thing. But, like, just, you know, we need to know. And I said, I don't think that it is. I think that this is a stepping stone. I think this is where we figure out who we are, and that our shoes are a lot bigger than this. And he said, okay, well, I think we need to explore. And it was very much a, okay, you know, like, I'm going to follow your lead on this, because I do think that someday we're going to look back and we're going to go, man, I hope we have a recipe somewhere in here that we'd really, really like.
It only took us 91 barrels, but we got it.
Yeah, we do say, I mean,
we only have 8 more to go. We better, hopefully
one of these are,
yeah, or 9 more to go. Yeah.
It is very humbling to say that, you know, it took us 91 tries to get it right, but we feel like we did. And I feel like I'm fortunate to have lived in a research and development environment for a few years in my previous career, where you do realize that trying things with slightly different variables just makes a pretty big impact. So I don't think we could have rationalized doing the same thing over and over again and not learning something from every day that we were there. So, you know, if we would have spent 2 years working on 5 recipes, those 5 recipes would have been good, but they wouldn't have evolved in the way that we were led to these 2 products and a bunch of other products. So our larger production facility now, you know, we're running about 25 barrels a week there currently, and we've scaled up close to about 12 recipes up to that location, and we can thank the experimental distillery for those others as well.
How did you figure out through the process, like, how are we going to recreate this magic, right? Like, we know this is barrel 91. There's some spreadsheet somewhere that says this was tweaked to what, this was the formula, blah, blah, blah. How do we
hate it?
Yeah. How do we go 3x on this?
That was my question too. go ahead.
And I never had a very good response for it.
Well, I think you said it's going to be different. You know, yeah. We got to figure out, it's just, you know, you're going from 100-gallon pot still, 3 100-gallon fermenters, 100-gallon cooker to a 3,000-gallon cooker, 4, you know, 3,000-gallon fermenters and a column still with a, you know, 100-gallon doubler.
Yeah, I mean, we kind of embraced the fact that it would be different. We knew that even a column still, for instance, is going to yield a slightly cleaner product, let's say. A pot still, just by its nature, is a little, you know, not as sanded down as you've called it. And we knew for experimental whiskey, that was great because it has a lot of nuance and a lot of complexity. But for an everyday whiskey, our signature recipe that we were looking for, we knew that a column still was going to bring us what we wanted. So as much as we looked at barrel 91 and said, this is great, we love it, it's going to change a little bit. But it's high notes, it's top notes of, you know, a little bit of fruit, a little bit of caramel, a little bit of honey character, a little bit of, you know, a little bit of everything. And we'll find some ways to pull that flavor out of every part of the process again and again. That's where our focus became is more on scaling up, trying to replicate that magic, but realistically in a different environment. I don't know if that answers your question, but
no, I think you're there. And so let's fast forward a little bit here, because I want to kind of know exactly, all right, so you've got the production facility, you're putting down barrels, and, you know, 1 year, 2 years past, you're tasting whiskey, or you're like, guys, I think we did it. I think we did it. Like, what was that?
Blind, I would say, right?
Yeah, this is where. So Grant made me comfortable at the experimental, and then it was my turn to make him uncomfortable at Riverfront. Absolutely. So when we established Riverfront, we started laying down barrel 91 recipe, and then we scaled up a handful of other recipes. But the focus was, how's barrel 91 going to evolve compared to what we selected as the actual barrel 91 out of experimental? How's it going to compare? And, you know, Grant is very much throughout that process, he's very much like, look, I'm not going to, I don't even really want to taste it until we're ready to release it. Like, because it's just going to evolve. You know what I mean? And when it comes time to release it, okay, it's time to taste it. Whereas I'm way less patient. Yeah. And I'm
just, I would be tasting every 2 months.
And that's what I was doing. And like I said, going back to experimental, when we really didn't have anything experimental aged to go off of, and it was just white whiskey, we were making decisions based off of what we liked in white whiskey. And when we started laying it down at Riverfront off of the column and the doubler, we both thought, man, this is really good white whiskey. It was super flavorful. I mean, some of the most flavorful white whiskey I've ever had. It was great, but, you know, we didn't know what it would do in a barrel. And so I would drill in occasionally after a few months, and then after a year, and, you know, it wasn't ready. It wasn't ready
yet. Barrel 91 had like 10 bottles left.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's right. it wasn't ready yet. and we got, so when I remember specifically when it hit 19 months, I remember pulling a sample at 19 months, and I hadn't pulled a sample in a few months. There was some time between a year and that time, that 19 month time period, that it turned a corner. And I remember pouring the sample out, nosing it and being like, okay, that actually smells really, really good. And then tasting it and feeling like, wow, this is so good and so further advanced than what I had been tasting up to a year, a little bit after. I wanted to tell him about it. And he was just like, I don't even want to know about
it
yet. Don't even, yeah, like I'm still laying it down. And I went to our sales director, John, and he tasted it and he was just like, that's really, really good. So I said, screw it. I'm just going to start blind tasting people on it. It's 19 months old. I'm going to blind taste again. I'm just going to blind taste people on it against anything.
And just say like, I'm going to go get a second barrel real quick just to make sure.
Yeah, right. Yeah. One. Well, that happened too. I think we tapped into quite a few, but I just started, I took those 100 ml samples and I just started walking into account. Grabbing
just to
some.
To clarify, this is the stuff we laid down at Riverfront, not the original
right.
barrel
yes.
91.
Yep. This is the stuff that we laid down. This is the barrel 91 recipe that we were laying down as our flagship at Riverfront. And so I was taking 19 and 20 month old samples from in 100 ml bottles that were not labeled. And I was inviting in top accounts, bar managers, professional bartenders, chefs. I mean, people that had what I believed were excellent palates. And I was blind tasting them on it against some of the best stuff in the industry. And it was regularly winning. And I would just ask, I would ask them to rank it among the whatever the samples they were sampling against, and then guess the age. And they were wrong. They ranked it extremely highly, and they guessed the age wrong 100% of the time. They all felt like it was, 6 to 10, somewhere between 6 and 10 years old is what I got from all of those blind tastings. And this wasn't 3 blind tastings. This was probably 30, 40 blind tastings. Unique individuals that were from the industry.
You needed a lot of confirmation.
Yes, I did. Yeah.
Tim does look for confirmation.
I do.
One of his strengths.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So that at that point, I felt like I went to Grant with these results, and it was just me going out on my own and getting these results.
He's like, now you got to try it. 40 people have tried it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that process actually, I would, when he said, I'm going to go out and start tasting people blind, I was like, oh my, what?
I cannot. We're not ready. We're not ready. Abort, abort.
Please don't do this. And it completely turned my, it really helped with our distilling team's entire confidence. We internally, there were moments where it was at probably 16 months, I think, where I was looking at our team like, I don't know. I don't know if this is going to be ready when we really want it to be ready. And it turned a corner and Tim started doing those blind tastings. And I was part of a few of them, and they were, it was one of the coolest things, one of my fondest memories of the entire process. But the one thing that I remember time and time again, and it kind of leads on to the whys of everything, is people start to ask, why is it so good? So young. And it really reinforces all the work that we put in.
That was
going to
be my next question.
Yeah.
Caramel flavoring.
Yeah, flavor packs.
Big drum of it. Glug, glug. Two glugs. So it's a really great opportunity to start to teach people about the foundational elements like malt and even the auxiliary really supporting acts like our fermentation process and our selection of barrels from our coopers and the entry proof and the distillation proof. Yeah, I'd love to.
Talk about a little bit of that. Talk about your entry proof, distillation proof, what kind of barrels you use, just so we can
char level.
Oh, yeah, everybody. Totally. Let people geek out for a minute.
So at its foundation, it's appropriate that, when we're speaking about the foundation of Tennessee High Malt that we
talk about malt a lot up front. It's a straight bourbon whiskey, so 75% corn. The other 25% is divided between approximately 25%. We say 25% or greater. In this particular recipe, Tennessee High Malt is right at 25% of rye malt in the highest quantity, so around 12. Then approximately 7-ish of caramel malt, a particular type of caramel malt, and then what is called honey malt, as well as the third ingredient at the rounding out the last 6%. So those three malts and that corn combined together to really create, the corn is a nice sweet canvas. It gives you a nice kind of caramel popcorn, I think, backbone to the whole profile. And then the rye gives you a nice rye malt instead of raw rye, gives you a heightened kind of baking spice character. So we attribute a lot of the baking spices like cinnamon, nutmeg, you know, deep kind of allspice character to the rye malt. Caramel malt, I like to say, enhances a lot of the barrel character because caramel malt is caramelized. They've stewed it and then they've roasted it to caramelize the inside. If you break open the malt, it's glassy on the inside. It's been caramelized and it's almost like this amber color. It looks almost like, you know, yeah, it's just kind of like, looks like the whiskey. So that's the inside of caramel malt. And then honey malt has got this nice sweet floral element, a little tart when you taste it, and it brings in kind of a nice honey note. And they call it honey malt, not because there's honey in it, and they call it caramel malt, not because it's actual like caramel put in it, but they've in the malting process, in the kilning and roasting process, they've created these flavors that are indicative of those types of ingredients. So those four grains together create this broad spectrum of flavors that have characteristics that when put into a barrel really synergize well with the barrel character. Now, backing up into terms of fermentation, the next step, fermentation, a lot of the industry goes pretty quickly, 2-3 days, sometimes maybe 4 days is the kind of general vibe in the industry. We usually go right around 7 days, 6 to 8, so average of 7. And that long fermentation for us builds a lot of that complexity. Over the first 2-3 days, most of the fermentation is done. Most of the alcohol has been produced. But during the fermentation process as well, there's not only alcohol production, but ester production. So alcohols and acids coming together to create aromas that are indicative of fruit, you know, apple, pear, pineapple, you know, the list could go on. And our fermentation process, when it hits around 4 days, it's kind of undergoing a little bit of a secondary fermentation process from 4 to 7. And the industry tends to call that transesterification. So in our distillery, we've got open-topped fermenters. We let the bacteria, the native flora of our environment come and kind of have an influence on them. And what happens is bacteria like Lactobacillus will come in, create their own acids and a little bit of their own alcohols. And what happens there is they start to change the existing esters and existing alcohols into other compounds. So you create new fruit aromas and new fruit flavors and all this other complexity on the back end of the fermentation. And we want that. We feel like that is that creates a more nuanced product. Along with that, we temperature control during that 7 day period. So temperature controlling allows us to not necessarily highlight just one particular ester or esters overall, but it subdues ester formation a little bit to highlight the malt character, which obviously we're all about. So
you can definitely get the malt out of it. That's for sure.
So ester suppression a little bit, malt kind of showcasing, and that covers our first two parts, you know, the grain selection and fermentation. Then we go into distillation. We distill at a relatively low proof for the industry, I would guess. We're coming off our main still at around 123 and off of our doubler at 134 in between that number. And what that does is it preserves all of that fermentation nuance, that malt complexity in our product, And, you know, if you went too high, you wouldn't taste any of that stuff. If you went too low, it probably would be a little bit gritty and a little too, you know, rough around the edges. So we picked that 133, 134 as the final proof prior to dialing it down into the barrel. So our barrel entry proof is right around 115. I would say anywhere from 114 to 116. And we do occasionally experiment, even at our production facility, with slightly lower, slightly higher entry proofs. But that 115 proof we found is a great balance between extracting the wood-based flavors from the barrel and then also extracting more of that sweet caramel undertone from the barrel. And then one final element is we have a mix of barrels as well. So half of our barrels are a number four char, the other half are a number three char, but with a toast.
Because you guys hate consistency, apparently.
Yep. Yeah. We try to make everything as complicated as possible so that we don't remember how we did anything.
Can't scale anything.
Yeah. Half 50% of them, fortunately, each batch is around eight barrels. So half of them, four of them go into number four char, the other go into a number three char with a toast. The toasting process, as your listeners probably know, toasting is like searing a steak. You know, it's usually less than a minute, high temperature, you're lighting the barrel on fire, and you're creating some caramelization reactions there. But you aren't going very, very deep into the barrel from an extractive perspective.
You said toasting, you mean charring.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. So charring is less than a minute, usually. Toasting, on the other hand, is, in our case of our toast profile, goes around 35 minutes. And that's like slow roasting. So it's going deep into the barrel, creating a lot of interesting extractives, you know, the coconut kind of lactone-y flavors, deeper vanillas, caramelization reactions that go very deep, and you're creating probably a greater number of them as well. So we found that the combination of these two barrel types, just yielded a complexity that we couldn't replicate any other way. And it tipped the cap to our original recipe from the standpoint of toasting and charring, that original barrel 91, and it gave us the complexity that we were looking for throughout our process. I could go on and mention our Solera finishing for 91 and unfiltered casks, single fermentation. But if you guys, I've been talking a lot, I want to make sure if you have any questions.
What's cool for our team is that every time so we have a 4,000 gallon white oak Solera barrel. That is, you know, 91 is a Solera barrel finished bourbon. So every time they load in the Solera barrel, they'll pull barrels from the warehouse and then they'll thieve them. And we, you know, the team, whoever's available, will go back there. The distilling team obviously is key to this process, but some of the other team will come back there and they'll try. Basically, we get to try a bunch of single barrels. And because the batches are half four char and half three char with a toast, you really get to see what the difference is, because it's the same recipe. These barrels have been put away at the same time. It's astounding. I mean, when you get to try a product that is the same recipe, that is, you know, greater than 2 years old, that is, and if half of, you know, you get to try barrels that, let's just say, for example, and this is most of the time, this is the case, four barrels, four different single barrels, same recipe, four char, versus four different, you know, four barrels that were put away at the same time, same recipe, but are in a three char with our own toast profile on there.
Just night and day.
Night and day. Huge difference. Unbelievable. I mean, we're talking, let's just say within bourbon whiskey, 20%+ different between these two. What we've kind of noticed is that these three char with a toast put off a very confectionery note versus the four char. Four char is definitely we've seen it to be like more in the
classic.
More classic, more traditional.
Bob's Basic Bourbon.
but here's the thing is when you have, occasionally, you know, people will be given a tour, or, you know, a friend from the industry will be in, they'll try it. And there are people that, you know, it's amazing the difference in palates and consumers, because there's a lot of people that just want a traditional bourbon whiskey. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you'll have people that will just automatically gravitate towards the three char with the toast because of how confectionery and flavorful it is. And then you'll have people that'll just automatically gravitate towards the four char because they just want that classic bourbon taste. So when you, you know, the art of marrying them together in the Solera barrel is just something that, you know, we're really proud of because of how different it is.
And then when you release these, so you have a 90 proof and then you also have 111 proof.
91.
Right? 91. Yeah. Okay.
To honor barrel number 91.
Yeah. Oh. Everything's barrel 91.
Yeah, right.
It all, yeah, it we all can.
And back. By the all way, right. Barrel 91 was the last barrel to go into the Solera barrel. So,
oh, fair.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's really cool. And so what was the idea of coming out with the higher proof version as well? Because for me, that's where my sweet spot is. Like, I love it. I love the aroma. I love the taste.
Yeah, you know, it's got a great viscosity.
Thank you.
Like, it's everything that you get with it. And, you know, I think for me personally, you know, coming into this, you know, we used to be, you know, very proud Kentucky boys, right? Like, we wouldn't drink anything else but it. But, you know, coming and finding something that is uniquely different. Yeah,
it's such a nice change of pace.
That's like, awesome. Thank you, guys.
Well, and it's that. And it's like, and you don't get this flavor profile from pretty much anywhere else, right? And that's what I really enjoy about this, that, you know, for me, when I look at my wall of bourbon, I try to figure out, what do I want? And if it's like sometimes when I'm looking for something that is a little more chocolatey, a little more like a dessert kind of thing, I typically reach for this because it does. It has that kind of profile that is just, it's not in your face. It's just, I don't know. I really, yeah, there's something about there. I love it though.
It's something you can like, some people call stuff like porch sipping whiskey or something, you know, like something you can just sit in the summer or just, you can chill with it. And it's like, it's so silky, sexy. I don't know. There's something about it that, but it has those fruit note flavors too. And then like, I get so much coconut out of it that like, I usually don't get, you know, out of many bourbons. We kind of,
almond joy. I love that's one note
that we try to find, but like it's here and it's fantastic. But I like the 91 too, because it has, like you said, more of those like honey, kind of like tea flavors. It's real approachable and easy. And it's just, it's a guzzler almost. Like you could get in trouble with it because it's so delicate but rich at the same time.
Yeah. So the two expressions, we tried to peel them apart of that original recipe and really showcase all that this recipe can be. And the way that we did it with 91 is to put it into the Solera barrel. The Solera is a great way for a small distiller, you know, comparatively speaking, small distiller to have a bit of quality control from a consistency standpoint. We take a 2+ year old whiskey. Once it's reached 2+ year old, it tops up our Solera. And our Solera is 4,000 gallons. So it holds about 91 barrels. We draw it down about 10 barrels each time. So a little over 10% goes away, makes a batch, and then we top it up with newly mature whiskey. So it's essentially a never-ending barrel, never goes empty, creates a lot of complexity over time, but also consistency. So as you can imagine, a 91 barrel batch of whiskey over time is going to create a little less consistency, variability from batch to batch. But the other cool thing about it is that not only the Solera creating complexity, but it has access to air still. This tank is made of wood. It's charred on the inside, and it has access to oxygenation. And anytime any beer or wine or spirit has access to oxygen, it can undergo continue to change and evolve over time. So we find that it blooms a little bit in there and highlights a little more fruit character on the 91. Whereas 111, what we decided, somewhat at the last minute, you know, in the last couple months of tasting through barrels was, you know, having a nice, 6 to 10 barrel batch for our 111 expression, we found, okay, all of these expressions from batch to batch, it was, just showing us a little different side of 111 each time. So what we decided to do was make it a single fermentation expression. Each one of our fermenters makes right around 8 barrels. Let's get all of these 8 barrel batches together each time we need to make a batch of cask and let our distillers decide which one has what it takes to be cask. So we'll line up 5 batches that could be cask, line them up, which one is more cask forward, gives that rich confectionery note that, you know, we feel like exhibits that other side of the 91 barrel profile, and the distillers you know, it's a democracy. We decide basically the highest number of votes wins on which gets to be cast. So that's why on the back of our 111, we tell the story of a single fermentation, and we don't filter it as well. So you'll see a little ring of dust on the bottom of there. And it gives you, you know, hopefully a little more mouthfeel, fullness, and all the complexity that we want out of that.
Everybody loves seeing barrel char in their bottles,
yeah.
Though.
Yeah, right, love on those floaters.
It also comes from, I mean, 1816 Reserve also had a cask, and that was 1816 cask. So 1816 Reserve was a 90 proof, cask was a 113.6 proof. So, I mean, our historically, Cheddar New Whiskey has had a product that is, you know, considered approachable to the everyday, you know, average whiskey drinker. And then, of course, a cask strength that appealed to the, you know, the more...
the nerds.
That appealed to the nerds. Yeah.
There we go. It's an easy way to put it.
Yeah.
So as we start wrapping this up here, you know, I got one last question to ask, and that is, you know, you had mentioned, you know, lots of different barrels, lots of different recipes, lots of different experimentations. You know, you've got, you know, this is probably one of your biggest flagship products that you have out here now, as well as 1816. What else can we expect to see from Chattanooga in the rest of this year and going into next year too?
So we launched Cheddar New Whiskey 91 and Cheddar New Whiskey 111 in August of 2019. So we haven't been out with those for a year yet. So what we're excited about is we have our foundation of 91 and 111, and that's our, you know, our straight bourbon whiskey foundation, which again we call Tennessee High Malt, our Tennessee High Malt foundation. Next is a Tennessee Rye Malt. So we are coming out with a true rye malt that we call Tennessee Rye Malt, and that we'll be releasing sometime around Q3 of 2020. And then we will start doing some single barrel offerings, although we're rolling those out more slowly because we want...
We'll be the 3 or 4 char.
Who knows?
That's the beauty of options.
That's
right?
True. So, yeah. You mingle them all.
You guys decide.
Yeah. You go exactly. And there's 4 and you get 2 and 2, I guess.
Well, you know, and eventually, so we don't want to have a shelf set that's like 20 products. I mean, for the record, we've done 26 releases in less than 3 years.
Wow.
It's a lot. When you come to the Cheddar New Whiskey Experimental Distillery and you sit down at our tasting bar and you know, there's a mirror with, you know, 4 shelves, and you look at the top shelf from left to right, you know, on a, you know, 20 plus foot span is every one of our releases from when we released batch 001. It's a lot, but we obviously we're not scaling all those up. But because, like Grant said, we scaled up about a dozen of them, we're making plans on what to do with that, right? And we've scaled up a handful of unique recipes beyond our flagship Tennessee high malt recipes. And the next one, we feel like the next logical step is Tennessee rye malt and then single barrel. But we're looking at all these other recipes and deciding, you know, they might make really great single barrels in the future. And we might also do something creative with them in regards to a bottled and bond. So we've got, but you know, we're not looking at having like an everyday, you know, 12 product shelf set. It's going to be, you know, probably within 5 or 6 products. But I think because of all those other recipes that we've scaled up, I think in the next couple of years, we're going to be able to get really creative on single barrel offerings.
Awesome. And it was a pleasure for both of you to come on the show and be able to talk about all this today. You know, for Ryan and I, it's really an honor because what you all have created here is fantastic.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
And it's one of those things that, as we had said at the very beginning of the show, it's like you get a package in the mail and you're like, here we go again. But there, every once in a while, you find something that changes your mind. And you're like, I want to get behind this. I love it. It's a great product. And
an even better story. Like, oh my God.
Absolutely. Appreciate that.
Like, that's incredible. And it's like, it's true entrepreneurship, like going in it. Like, I've been there, you know, you just go in. You wouldn't know if you knew how hard it was, you wouldn't do it, but you just do it because you're passionate about it. And then bringing your side to it, you know, let's manage this, let's do this, like, let's refine it. You know, it's great to get both sides of the story. It was incredible.
Thanks.
Absolutely. And I encourage all of our listeners to go out, get a bottle of it, because if you're like me and you're listening to this bourbon podcast, you're probably a bourbon nerd. Try the 111.
Yeah.
I guarantee you're going to be like, yep, you're going to add it to your bar.
I'm hoping we can keep these ones since you got to keep the media sample.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I'll let you take. I'll get you a sample here. You can take 100 mL home. Is that a deal?
Enough.
Blind tasted.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So Grant and Tim, thank you again for coming on. You know, I wasn't give you also give you one last chance to say, you know, where you're distributed to, what states, and people can go and try to find it right now.
So Tennessee, Georgia, South Carolina, Florida, Alabama. We did just launch Kentucky, which we're really excited about. Mississippi, Colorado, and Texas are kind of next on the list. And then we're just going to kind of drive deep in those markets. We're not planning on being distributed in 50 states anytime soon. We'd really, we're just trying to be as methodical as we can about that. Check us out at chattanoogawhiskey.com. You can nerd out on our website. We actually provide a lot of information on our experimentals, and there's a lot of good info on there. So I definitely encourage people to check that out and follow us on our social channels. Instagram is Chat Whiskey, and Facebook and Twitter. So
yeah, and visit Chattanooga. It's my favorite city.
Yeah, thank you for saying that, because we're really proud of the experimental distillery experience. It's one of the top tourist experiences in Chattanooga. And we'd still experiment there. We still distill there and experiment there every week. So it is a production facility as well. And yeah.
We need to quit experimenting.
Thanks to this guy right here. Whenever. Yeah.
It was like, for me, I know we've had these conversations before. I'm just like, let's choose something and go forward.
Yep.
That's what I like.
Well, we try, you know, and there's a whole, that's a whole nother story about being focused versus being, and we, you know, we do feel like we're focused, but we can play a lot within straight bourbon whiskey and American whiskey. And
what's our tagline? Passion. The rules are
Are good. Change them. Yeah.
Yeah. Rules are good or change them. I like that.
Exactly.
Yeah. Cool. And then also, you know, also shout out to Blake at Seal Box, because I believe you can also get them online delivered to your door at sealbox.com. So again, Grant, Tim, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having us.
Absolutely. And if you like what you hear, make sure you support the show. You can go leave us a review at ratethispodcast.com/bourbon. You can also support the show, patreon.com/bourbonpursuit. And then follow us on all the social medias as well.
Yeah. Kenny gives some good, you know, pictures on social media. You know
we take back and forth from Instagram from time to time. You know, who's going to post this week? So
I get more likes. Anyways.
It's true.
Thanks, guys, for coming.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, and if anyone has any show suggestions, feedbacks, comments, we love hearing from our fans, because this is why we do it. So, with that, we'll see you all next time.
Cheers.
Thanks.